Senator Dietzick, Senate File 156.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your consideration is Senate File 156. This bill modifies the Tax-Exempt Bond Allocation Act. The bill makes changes to conform state law with federal law. The ability to issue bonds after the year in which the bonds are allocated is known as carry-forward, and this bill extends the carry-forward period from 1 year to the three-year maximum period permitted under federal law. This impacts first-time home buyers and small business loans and student loans. With me is Minnesota Housing Finance Assistant Commissioner Tonya Orr to go over the bill and answer any specific questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tonya Orr from Housing Finance.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you. Senator Dietzick really described this bill. It's really quite simple. We have had, as I'm sure you all know, a challenging time in the municipal bond market, and by making this change to conform to federal law, we will preserve for the state tax-exempt bonding authority that will help first-time home buyers and student loans.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Might be the quickest bill we've had this year. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 156? Anything else you want to say, Senator Dietzick?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I'll just say it was part of the bill that was, it's been around for a while. It was part of a bill that was vetoed last year, and so I'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Chair will lay Senate File 156 over for possible inclusion.
No, it's me.
Better rest.
Okay. Right. Mean to grill you so hard.
I know.
Yeah, she says, okay, something.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have Senate File 1533, and I have an author's amendment, please, which I would offer as the A1 amendment.
Pass the A1 amendment out. Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and members, almost every year, those that work in the areas of public finance get together and share ideas about how we can improve or make changes, modernize some of the statutes that affect their activity on behalf of governments as they are and economic development authorities as they are outdoing their work. And Senate File 1533 represents their work for this year. I did take out one section that had been a particular sore spot. I'm sorry she's not here for Senator Ortman, so that section in the bill is deleted. And I made some changes with regard to the including fiber optics in each of the sections that dealt with local governments being able to issue or have the kinds of activities that would be eligible for them to finance. And those were deleted. And then I added a section, which is also a bill that's on today's introductions, dealing with are coming from Dakota County. And Ms. Honey is here on their behalf, and I'll let her explain what kind of additional authority is being given to Dakota County, and also indicate that there are some concerns from some of the cities in Dakota County, and we are will work with them to make sure that they are comfortable with the language with regard to participation by the cities in approving the projects that would be financed through this additional authority.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Kathy Honey. I'm a lawyer at Fagry Baker Daniels. And with apologies, I'm actually wearing two hats today. I do represent the Institute of Public Finance that sponsored the base bill and work with Senator Rest on Senate File 1533. I also represent the Dakota County Community Development Agency, who is the entity seeking the amendment relating to housing improvement areas. In Dakota County, the Community Development Agency, formerly a Housing Redevelopment Authority, is the housing economic development engine entity in Dakota County. Their board is composed of Dakota County commissioners. So they have an elected board, and they work with the cities in Dakota County. You've heard legislation prior this year already on housing improvement areas and how important this tool is in working with townhouse associations in terms of trying to help them basically with the financing to do the rehab, repairs, those kinds of things that's necessary to provide upgrades for them. And the recession has been particularly hard on those kinds of developments. And so the CDA is proposing that they in their special law, they have the powers essentially as a city in doing basically a resolution approved by their board, which again are our county commissioners, in terms of then what would be like an ordinance as to a housing improvement area that would be certain, you know, what cities that are interested in doing that, but then can be put together countywide. Just looking for efficiency, effectiveness, and then being able to issue debt at a much more efficient basis. So it doesn't change any of the underlying housing improvement area law, which requires petition, which has got all kinds of safeguards for the homeowners on it, notices, public hearings, et cetera. It only lets, in this case of the CDA, sort of move it up from a city level to a county level. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Haney.
And Mr. Chairman, if there are any additional questions about the bill, Ms. Crandall is here also to answer them. But I think that it just basically some additional authority and some improvements in the way in which local governments finance their economic development projects.
Senator Rest, can I draw your attention to Section 4? Page 2, line 33. Do we have a little discussion about the purpose of software's useful life?
Mr. Chairman, we did take out the on lines 3.3 and 3.4 with regard to fiber optics, but just to make sure, we did that at every point because that was causing some heartburn, and the House did the same thing. What it does,
has that been removed?
The fiber optics is removed in every section. In Section 4, in Section in Section 7, and in Section 8.
Okay, what about the language, the new language on line 33?
Okay, I'm going to ask Ms. Crandall to give the thinking of the parties on how this is going to be helpful to them.
Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, my name is Lynette Slater-Crandall, and I'm a bond lawyer with the Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm. I am also a vice chair of the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. And the provision relates to allowing for bonding of the hardware and software without respect to useful life, because typically those are very short-lived assets. Generally, when we're thinking about long-term financing of assets, we want the term of the bond to match the life of what's being financed. In this case, again, because of the unique nature of technology, we're seeking this exception to enable our issuer clients to finance that type of an asset in connection with other improvements related to the technology. However, just to let you know, there are restrictions at the federal level as well, so it is not possible to issue tax-exempt debt for a term that exceeds 120% of the useful life of all of the assets that are being financed. So, for example, you couldn't just do computer hardware and software, you know, that maybe has a useful life of, I'm guessing here, but a couple of years, and do a 10-year financing of that. So federal law would actually prohibit that.
Well, Ms. Crandall and Senator Rest, I do have concerns about, for exactly the reasons that you said you're seeking exemption, this language. Maybe we'll
Mr. Chairman, I respect that, and I would move to delete Section 4.
Any questions, members? Senator Rest moves to delete Section 4. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Sure.
Anything else, members?
Any other concerns, Senator, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Silva is bringing to my attention that the without regard to language is included in a number of other areas dealing with development services and training, computer hardware and software. This might be part of a larger discussion. We have changes in the bill now. Let's have a larger discussion.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, members? Anybody else? Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm just looking at the bill, and I just have a question. Maybe Ms. Haney wants to answer. But in the amendment, we're giving Dakota County the Housing Improvement Authority language. But I believe that the bill only repeals the sunset for the Special Service District and not the Housing Improvement District. And you might want to have a repeal of the sunset of the housing improvement. So I just wanted to point that I just now realized that it wasn't in the repealer.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Haney?
Mr. Chairman, it's not often that I'm a half a step ahead of Mr. Carlson, but I did check on that provision, and I am told by counsel that has more expertise than I do that the underlying law, that this would track the underlying law, and thus, if there's a repeal of the sunset or an extension of the sunset and underlying law, that would apply to this.
Okay.
So we're okay.
Double check.
So we're okay. I will double check. It's certainly a good question.
Thank you. Anything else? Another Mr. Carlson.
Another Mr. Carlson.
Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, I did not have the opportunity to speak to the changes that the committee made in Section 4 and the same provisions affecting cities in Section 8 and I believe Section 7, but I do want to point out that in addition to deleting the language without regard to its useful life, that frankly, again, for the reasons that were explained, does not really have much impact because of the federal law. You're also deleting the ability to bond for application development services and training relating to computer hardware and software. Oftentimes when a city or county invests in enterprise systems such as Oracle, the software itself is the smallest piece of the expenditure. The actual cost of having consultants or the vendor staff on site for usually what takes a number of months, if not a year or more, to integrate all their accounting systems, human resources systems, accounts receivable, accounts payable systems, is the biggest piece of the expenditure and where they're getting the most value. These contracts can easily run to $1 million or more, and by taking this tool away, you're limiting the ability of the public sector to catch up with the private sector and investments in this type of technology. So I respectfully request that you consider reinstating at least that language.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Crandall.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, too, I think that was a provision where there's been some disagreement among industry professionals as to whether that is implicitly included in the language as it exists or not. That would be a properly capitalized cost to the project, as I understand it. And so, again, something under state law and federal law that typically would be bond financed. There have been a few in the industry who have looked for express inclusion of that. We were happy to try to clarify that. But, again, I think it is it's historically been somewhat part of the process to include those services because, again, you couldn't have the functioning hardware without the related costs, again, that are capitalized to implement the systems.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I would suggest that since the section that we deleted specifically referred to counties, and as you noted, the other governments are still in there. All three provisions are still intact in the House article, and so just because we deleted the county one here, I think what that means is that we're going to have larger discussion about it, and if we grant it to one, that we'll come back and be consistent, or we'll take it away from all, if that's agreeable to you.
Sure. And Senator Ress, yes, that is agreeable, and I'm not opposed to when the software is a long-serving part of the county's tracking of Health and Human Service clients or something like that. I just want to be – I have a little concern about how broadly this can be utilized. That's something that I'd like a little more information on.
Put it on.
Anybody else would like to testify on Senate File 1533? Any other questions, members? Seeing none, thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I would then hope you would lay it over.
Yes, Chair will lay Senate File Number 1533 as amended over for possible inclusion.
You know, you go to some stores and they have coffee flavored ice cream. I can make it taste like that. And I'm okay.
We did the first two of coffee with milk. We did Dietzick and Rest. So we're on the third
Senator Scoy has the next two bills, Senate File 1536 and 1563. Senator Scoy. Which bill would you prefer to take up first?
Let's stay with the agenda.
Senate File 1536, modifying PILT payments. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here today with an effort to do a couple of things with regard to payment in lieu of taxes for public lands. There was a group that worked with DNR, I don't know if it's been over a year, but certainly last summer, on some issues regarding PILT payments. And so I've incorporated some of those initiatives in this bill, and I've got the representative from the DNR to help me walk through the group. I was not on the group that worked on this language. I also have included some other initiatives of my own And I think it would be most helpful to just turn to the department and walk through the bill so the members can get a good handle on what's going on there.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record, we'll get to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Damon. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources.
Ms. Damon.
I'll just walk through the bill section by section. Section 1 sets forth purposes of payment in lieu of taxes. This was a recommendation of the Commissioner's Advisory Group. Sections 2 and 6 amend some of the definitions in Minnesota statutes, Section 477A11, and the purpose of these amendments is to bring some of the provisions pertaining to PILT that are currently in Minnesota statute Section 97A.061 into the main PILT law, which is in the Local Government Aid Chapter 477A. Section 7 provides for inflation adjustments for all flat rate payments.
Oh. Madam Chair, as we're going through the bill,
Senator Scoy?
I have an amendment.
Okay.
I have an amendment.
Maybe we should put that on first.
I think we should. It'll change the testimony.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the amendment removes all the inflation indexes from the amendment removes all the inflation indexes from
okay.
the provisions.
It is an author's amendment. I just want to make sure everybody has it. And so Senator Scorey offers the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So we have the inflation and indexing provisions removed from the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So now we'll proceed on that basis. Ms. Damon.
Okay, with the amendment, then, Section 7 provides for payments for wildlife management land and military game refuges, and that, again, brings provisions that are currently in Section 97A into Chapter 477A. Also provides
Excuse me,
for.
I have just a question
sure.
as we're going forward. Senator Scoy, does that amendment change the revenue estimate?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would change the revenue estimate, and I do. It would reduce it in the tails. Sure.
Okay, so right now it's for FY 2014. It's $5 million and. It continues at about $5 million.
I see Ms. McQuay is back. Perhaps she could address that.
Ms. McQuay, do you know what effect the amendment we just adopted has on the revenue estimate?
Madam Chair and members, I'm looking at the current revenue estimate, and it looks like it looks like inflation will start earlier than the tails, but I'm not quite sure. I'd just like to have a conversation with revenue about
okay.
that. And
right.
I don't think it will significantly decrease it, probably just keep it flat.
Madam Chair, the DNR has some ideas on this.
Okay. I mean, that is a, you know, it's $5 million.
Yes, I did speak with a staff member at the Department of Revenue yesterday, and they hadn't seen the amendments, but the estimate is that it would reduce the amount to about $4.45 million per year.
Okay. Okay, please continue.
So back to Section 7. This also provides for increases in a number of the current flat rate payments that are made for PILT. The types of increases are for county-administered other natural resources land. The increase would be from $1.283 per acre to $1.50 per acre. For land utilization project land, the increase would be from $1.283 per acre to $5.13 per acre. And for DNR administered other natural resources land, the increase would be from $0.642 to $1.50 per acre.
Madam Chair,
Senator Skoy.
Some of this is not included in the PILT group's work recommendations. This is some of my effort, but it's an effort to reduce the number of rates, and we, if this is to be accomplished, we would then have two rates.
As opposed to?
I think there's currently three, but there's also other factors that play into that.
Yes, there are currently three flat rates, but there's also acquired land can be paid either on a flat rate of $5.13.3 per acre or on 0.75% of the appraised value of the land, whichever is greater. And most of the counties do receive their payment on acquired land at the 0.75% of appraised value.
Okay.
Okay, moving on to Section 8, this would remove provisions in the current PILT law that make goose management croplands and payments for Wild River State Park ineligible for payments. These are older laws that the goose management cropland payment was a special law that predated the main PILT law. And so those lands would be just be rolled into the 0.75% rate instead of having a special rate. Section 9 changes. There's currently a five-year reappraisal cycle for acquired lands, and this would change that cycle to coincide with reappraisals that county assessors do every year for the every 3 to 6 years to for the Department of Revenue for exempt lands. Section 10, I believe the amendment then deletes that. Okay. Section 11 provides for an increase in the township share of the acquired natural resources lands payment. That share is currently 51.3 cents per acre, and it would change that amount to 10% of the amount received. That would enable the townships to get a share of the value, the appraised value rate, rather than having it tied to a flat rate.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
To that point, prior to the change to the valuation, I believe, the townships got 10% of the PILT payment. When this changeover was made, the counties actually received an increase in the amount of PILT that they got, but they didn't share the increase with the township. So the township share actually reduced to a smaller number than 10%. This is restoring the 10%.
Okay.
And Section 12 amends the distribution provision in 477A.14 to provide for distribution of payments that are currently made under Minnesota Statute Section 97A.061 and brings those payment distributions within the LGA PILT law. The distribution for those payments that are currently made under Section 97A.061 is like a tax on the land, and it differs from the distribution formula that is paid for the lands that receive their payment under Chapter 477A.
What county is being referred to specifically in Section 12?
That would apply to the military refuge lands that are referred to there. That is just Morrison County. That's the Camp Ripley Game Refuge. But the wildlife management lands, that would apply to any county that has wildlife management areas.
No, I'm asking, so for a county, am I reading in the summary, what county is it that had a population of over 39,000, less than 42 in the 1950 federal census? Who is that?
That is Winona County. That was a special law that was passed that they have their own distribution formula, and the county doesn't get any of the distribution. It it goes to the township and the school districts.
And Senator Skoy, why is that good public policy?
Madam Chair, I'm learning about Winona County as we go along.
Okay. Yes.
And Winona County has what cities in it?
City of Winona.
City of Winona.
Is it, I mean, is it just, well, sometimes those county names don't coincide with the county. So Winona is the chief city within Winona County. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. And I think this was one of the recommendations of the working group. And I'm assuming, and I wasn't part of the group, so it's an assumption, but that they just didn't make changes to distributions to counties that had their own distribution mechanism that was what they wanted. But I'm that's an assumption on my part.
Just as a curiosity.
Yeah,
if I may add, Senator, this,
why it's inconsistent.
This is currently in Chapter 97A 061, and this just moves the language that's currently in 97A 061 to
477. I'm not questioning that it's in current law. I'm just questioning why it's in current law. That's all. If there was special circumstance or, when you do move language from one place to another, what happens, as you know, Senator Scoyes, you draw attention to it. So,
Senator Rest, my understanding is that law had something to do with the acquisition of Whitewater State Park, of land for Whitewater State Park, and that's all I was able to find out in researching the history.
And curiosity.
Madam Chair, the reason for the Center move scoring? Is to take some of this language is currently in two sections, obviously, the aids and credits and the fish and game, and we're taking it out of the fish and game portion and putting it in the aids and credits, which we think is more appropriate.
Sure. Okay, and then Section 13, fairly straightforward.
Section 13, is that deleted?
I think that was deleted.
Are there any questions for Senator Scoy or Ms. Damon on Senate File 1536?
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm testing my recollection. Is this land always public land, or could it be private land designated to a wildlife manager? Okay.
Ms. Damon.
Senator, Madam Chair, the PILT payments are made on state-owned natural resources land. There are also the land utilization project payments are made on land that is actually held in fee title by the federal government but leased by the state for wildlife management purposes.
So it's all public land.
It's all public
one
land.
Sort or another.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Senjan.
In our neck of the woods, so to speak, and probably all over, groups like Pheasants Forever and so on have a lot of land. They've put in some sort of a wildlife category forever and ever, so to speak. That wouldn't apply.
Ms. Damon.
Madam Chair, Senator, unless that land were transferred to the state of Minnesota, there would not be a PILT payment for it.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Senjan, there's a number of categories of state-owned land from the scientific and natural areas to WMAs. There's state forest land, CONCON lands, acquired lands, and they all have had different mechanisms, and we're trying to clean that up and streamline this and actually also give them a small increase in the PILT payments, as they're providing services on these public lands. The local units need some resources to help provide services.
Senator Scoy, the reason for the increase comes from which sections of the, and I haven't read the revenue estimate, but why is it costing more in FY14, even with the inflation out? Let's say it's $4.5 million. What is causing the increase in these payments?
Madam Chair, the working group recommended an inflation adjustment on PILT. They did not recommend an increase. I'm removing the inflation adjustment, so I gave them an increase.
Okay. But it's still, it's an increase going forward, but it's not an inflation-adjusted increase. Okay.
Madam
and the
Chair,
reason why you felt that and the group feels that an increase is warranted is?
Well, costs are rising on providing services on the land. I just think, as with other things, it's good for legislators to look at those things going forward as opposed to having an automatic mechanism.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Senator Skoy on Senate File 1536? Seeing none, Chair lays over Senate File 1536 as amended. The next bill is 15.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
1563, Senator Skoy.
1563. I don't know if I have any testifiers on this or not, but I will walk through this best as I can. Members, this is an effort to take a look at the current truth and taxation mechanism that the state has. And as many of you know that have been local government officials, after levies are certified and the notices have gone out, local units of government hold, and I think it's probably required, but all the ones I attended were an evening meeting where the public has an opportunity supposedly to come and get in and put input into the local government budgeting process. In practicality, by the time the levies are certified, the budgets are all set by these local units. The county board meeting, or truth and taxation meetings, and the school board truth and taxation meetings that I attended as a member, to be honest with you, the budgets were set prior to the truth and taxation meeting. And this is an effort to change that, to try to make this so that the meeting actually has some ability, the input received at the meeting actually has some ability to impact the outcome. And so we're proposing to move this. My first proposal was to move it into June, and I think there's an amendment, and if there isn't, I'm going to have to make an oral amendment. I heard from school boards and cities that was too early, and they wouldn't have their levies known at that point. So I'm going to propose to move the date from June to September 30th, and this is not a provision that's being moved forward in the House, but I think it's a decision or discussion worth having. You know, our local units are spending a lot of resources on this truth and taxation mechanism that we currently have in Minnesota. Very few people attend the meetings. And those that do, I think, are frustrated because they realize that the ability to impact the outcome is, they're already too late. So I wanted to move it up so that when concerned citizens come forward with regard to levy or spending decisions that local units are making, their input could actually affect the outcome. And so I brought forward Senate File 1563, and I do need to change the date that's in here. And I,
Mr. Sylvia, where is the September 1st. In what section is the date?
Madam Chair and members, on page 6, section 2, and the date reference is found on line 6.
Oh, it says September 1st.
So this is not June 1st, but
no, September 1st,
but you want to move that to September 30th?
30th.
So, Senator, is that the only place?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
So Senator Skoy moves on page 6, line 6, strike 1 and insert 30.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that.
We'll take that as an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Skoy, there is a letter in our package from the MLC. I don't know if they're present. But maybe they could come forward and share their concerns. And I've just read through it. Oh, I see there's some others, too. I've read through it briefly, and it looks like to me the concerns are how the timely manner in which they could receive the information that would be necessary to provide the taxpayers. But we'll see if September 30th addresses their concerns. But Senator Skoy.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the input from any of the groups that are out there with concerns. I do know that there is a concern because this, if this was to move forward as currently drafted, it would eliminate the notice being mailed out. You know, sometime in the end of the year, you receive a notice of what your proposed taxes are going to be for the following year, which I guess is fine for information purposes, but it isn't providing any information that the taxpayer can actually go to the local unit government and impact the outcome with. It's just information sake, and I guess that has some value, but I thought that it would be good if we could come up with some mechanism so that when people have concerns, there was actually some reasonable expectation that there was an opportunity for change, which currently doesn't occur.
Senator Skoy, I do, if it's a notice I'm thinking of, it does give me an indication, however, how much my taxes are going to be and how much I don't escrow mine, I pay them. So that I know exactly, so I feel the bite
yes.
at the proper time. And so it does give me warning about whether I'm going to have to set aside more money before waiting until April or whenever and actually getting the property tax notice so that it's not a shock to me, either a savings, as it's been in recent years, or an increase. But up for discussion.
Absolutely aware of the concern there. I just was thinking that, you know, if it's a budgeting issue, I mean, a couple of months, you know, it's probably not going to make a lot of difference to people. You're going to get all that information on your property tax statement. And so, you know, as I've indicated, this is just I really want to have a discussion about if there's ways we can improve this, and that's why we're here today.
And, you know, and Senator Skoy, and we'll hear from Mr. Schreiber and members, but when Truth in Taxation was first put in, it did generate tremendous interest on the amount of taxpayers, and they were at mostly in out in the suburbs that I represent, people would go to the Hennepin County Truth in Taxation meeting, and they go to the city ones. Not so much the school district, because the school district wasn't really in charge of, you know, we were telling them what they had to levy, and so that was not, there was very little discretion on the part of the school districts, even with regard to the, you know, referendum levy that they might have. But there was a lot of interest in the cities and the counties, and it seemed to me that over time there's been less and less interest, and I don't know whether that the effect of that is because the cities and the counties are much more on their, at least in our area, much more on their toes with regard to the truth in taxation, how accurate the truth in taxation notice is relative to the budget. And I think it's worthy of discussion, but it is true that hardly anybody ever shows up anymore. But I think, I think that's a good thing. That means it's been effective in my mind. But maybe it needs a little bit more juice or something.
Sure.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, of the working property tax working group, the two areas that I picked up on this year were the homestead classification changes, which, you know, I think obviously needed some work. And this was another area of concern the group had. So I just picked it up
sure.
to try to see if we could have it.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The one comment I was going to make is what you could, another option, and I don't know how you would require this, but you could have them do their final truth and taxation meeting where they get all this input and then schedule another meeting to discuss the budget afterwards. I know at Hennepin County, they did that the last few years where there was always a an extra meeting of the board to come back and maybe make changes that were suggested at Truth and Taxation. And I know in one meeting in the city of Minneapolis in the last few years with the downturn and the recession, we probably had about 200 people show up at the city of Minneapolis. And the city council did make changes to the budget then because of people showing up. And so that is, I don't know if we could require them to have a meeting to discuss the budget after the Truth and Taxation to possibly make adjustments. That's just another thought. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, to Senator.
Senator Skoyne.
Well, there is a meeting required in here. And it is an evening budget meeting. It's just that it's a little earlier.
Right.
And the notice is not out because the levy hasn't been certified.
Madam Chair, follow up on that, but you could also require, if it doesn't work for timing purposes, to do it in the beginning. You could require the meeting after the truth, so the board would have to meet after the Truth and Taxation meeting. So if it's a time frame in the beginning, because they don't get all the budget documents just don't flow correctly and they don't get fiscal disparities info, you could possibly require them to have a, you know, county meeting, board meeting, city meeting, whatever, after the Truth and Taxation to further discuss the budget.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Skoyne.
On page 6 is the discussion about the budget meeting. That's where I changed the date to the 30th. If you go down into sub B, the jurisdiction estimated proposed levy, prior final levy, percent change are required. Tax rate for the jurisdiction's estimated proposed levy, current tax rate, and percent change are required. A statement of reason for increase or decrease from the prior's levy are included, and the four most significant factors resulting in the change, plus an accounting of the distribution of levy proceeds from the previous year are required. So it's a, you know, we're trying to provide information to the public about what's going on with the local government. But we're trying to do it in a time frame that can actually have some impact. That's,
Madam Chair, I'd be interested in the testifier's
Senator
comments.
Senator Chamberlain.
I'd just be interested in the testifier's comments.
Sure.
If we could.
We get right to it. Mr. Schreiber.
Madam Chair, I'm Bill Schreiber with Meslin and Kramer, and we represent the Municipal Legislative Commission, which is 16 suburban communities.
And
all
it
of
is
which
their letter, members, that is in their packets.
All of which have a population of 25,000 or greater, which means they have computer capacity and websites and all of that type of things that many of the diverse cities around the state may not have. So we're talking about a segment here of the metropolitan area. I think we understand and sympathize with Senator Skoyne's desire to add transparency to the whole budgeting process. But the dates, now Senator Skoyne, this helps by going to September 30th as compared to September 1st. But as it relates to that preliminary levy that is made for the purposes of Truth and Taxation and your proposed property tax statements, that is the maximum levy. The maximum levy. And most cities, as they go through their budget process, end up with something less than the proposed maximum. So when the property taxpayer receives the proposed property tax statement, it really is the maximum that may occur. You're right that participation at these hearings has not been great. I don't know that that's so much of the process as it is the local elected official's sensitivity to what the economy has been experiencing. I mean, we have valuations that are occurring. It's very difficult to explain to someone how their property taxes are going up at the same time that their valuation is going down. And that's been happening. So I think our local elected officials have been very sensitive to the plight of their homeowners and business people in a struggling economy. Now, as it relates to the cities themselves and the data that they have, it's the county auditor that calculates the tax rates, not the city. So asking a city to have information in terms of making that calculation is not practical for them to be able to come out with that kind of information, even by, say, the 30th of September. So I think you need to bring the county auditors into this discussion and what's available and what isn't available as it relates to cities specific. The typical, among the suburban communities, the typical budgeting process starts with this maximum levy that they set the early part of September. And then the evaluation on department by department becomes for some of them, a very extensive process. And it's not unusual for a community to say, well, public safety is going to be our primary focus in this next year. And if we have to pare back in other areas, we may have to do that. We can't go over our maximum levy, but we want to add some additional police officers, and we're going to figure out a way to do that. They do that typically in the latter part of October, early part of November, so that when they're then ready for their truth and taxation hearings, they've made the adjustments, they've determined how they're going to do it. So I think the challenge is, what can we do to perhaps engage the public more in a meaningful time? And I think as it relates to rates and so on, that doesn't work for cities as in September. I think there are a lot of property taxpayers that really do like receiving that proposed property tax statement. We know a lot of business owners, particularly those that lease properties and have where their tenants are paying a proportion of that, they're able to alert the tenants earlier. Property tax statements don't come out until March, and being able to alert those tenants earlier as to what generally the change in property tax is going to be is quite helpful to them. So I think you should hear from the Carlsons that may also provide some insight on this. From MLC, we'd like to work with you. We don't know that this is going to achieve the results.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schreiber. Senator Chamberlain, did you have a question for Mr. Schreiber then, or?
No, that was fine. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Keith Carlson, did he want to speak on this? Bill? From Micah?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Thank the author for his willingness to hear our concerns with this bill, and he has in part acknowledged the timing issue with the amendment on lines 6.6 to the September 30th date. We basically concur with Senator Scoy's characterization that for the over $3 million that counties, cities, and school districts invest in the truth and taxation process, that we're getting very little return on our investment if the objective is to get people to turn out at these hearings. For many counties, the usual turnout is roughly half a dozen individuals. Half of those individuals are there to challenge the values on their properties, and this just isn't the forum to do that. That's at the separate Board of Equalization and Review hearings that occur in the early summer. The other half frequently are evenly spent between proponents for spending for specific programs and those individuals who actually have concerns about their taxes and want to discuss the city, counties, or school district's overall budget. On balance, we're getting one or two individuals who are really there to put pressure on the local government to reduce its levy, reduce its spending. I would concur with Mr. Schreiber that tax rates would be difficult to provide. Basically, the values that were necessary to provide that information is not provided to the counties until late August, and frequently because they're late on utility values or fiscal disparities values, we're into the first week or two of September before we even know the values that would be necessary to compute tax rates. And I'll also concur with, I think, the representation that tax rate alone is really not an indication of what the tax is for a particular parcel. That's a product of both the tax rate and the valuation. And I'll finally just mention our other concern is with the document that's referred to as a property percentile summary statement. I believe the intent is for the county to produce this on representative properties within each jurisdiction. Again, without the tax rate information, they can't do that, and they need the input of the levies of each jurisdiction, and there's no mechanism to provide that. So, again, we are happy to work with the author, with the committee, to come up with an answer to this question of allowing individuals input earlier in the process. I'll just mention one other issue that came up during the earlier questioning, Senator Dietzick's concern that the county, city, or school district adopt its budget or levy after this hearing. The statute does provide for that currently. They cannot adopt their final budget or levy until after the public comment. That used to be explicit in the statute that it had to occur at a subsequent meeting. It's not that precise right now. It just says that it cannot be adopted until after the public has been heard. So it's possible, but I think in practicality, almost all jurisdictions do still do it at a subsequent hearing. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to Mr. Carlson or Mr. Schreiber, if he's still here. My first question was going to be how much it costs to do the truth in taxation, so thank you for the $3 million. Have any of the cities or counties done anything on the web and gotten any info on their budget or any input back on their budget from any, you know, either through newsletters on the web, general newsletters, you know, aside from individual elected officials, but just in general, that I'm just trying to think of other ways to get impact and feedback from people without the $3 million.
Mr. Carlson?
So. Madam Chair, Senator, yes, many counties and cities do publish financial and budget information on their website. In addition, those that have newsletters also include that information within those documents as well. I will mention that we are required to file both preliminary and final budget information with the state auditor currently, and she, or whoever their current office holder is, does publish that on their website and also provides comparison tools to look at that information as well as the final financial statement. So much of this information is available to the public either directly on the city or the county school district's websites or in an aggregated basis at the state auditor's website.
Senator Dietzick, follow up, and then
yep.
Senator Orton.
Yep, Madam Chair, thank you. But is there any planned program or outreach effort that they get specific comments back on what they did that they post online? So is there any, you know, specific outreach effort to get feedback?
Madam Chair, I'll just relate one specific county's efforts in this area. Washington County did, in fact, do this preliminary budget hearing as envisioned by this bill. Unfortunately, the turnout was so poor at those, they've dropped those efforts in part because of poor turnout and in part because of the expense that they went to for advertising those hearings. It just wasn't resulting in the turnout that I think all of us hope for.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I disagree with the goal of the Truth in Taxation Notice as you stated it. You stated the goal was to get people to turn out. I disagree that that's the goal. I think the goal of having the Truth in Taxation Statement is connecting the property tax statement to an opportunity to be heard on the taxing and the budget. And I think if
folks have sat through enough city council or county board meetings, they know that it's really frustrating for an average person to try and figure out when to weigh in. Because the process, we have certain times for public testimony and other times when public testimony isn't actually allowed. And we've had board chairs in Carver County, I'm sure elsewhere, where people were told this was not the time for public testimony. And so even if people don't come to the Truth and Taxation meeting, I'm not sure that's not a success, because now you've given an opportunity for maybe a new property taxpayer, a new homeowner, a first-time homeowner, to understand the connection between the property taxes and how to hold the decision-makers accountable. And it also gives folks that have a political statement they want to make an opportunity to rally around a date. And so I think we should continue with it. The timing issue is a tougher issue. But I think you have to connect the property tax statement, the proposed property taxes, and a clear opportunity for the residents to be heard.
Senator Ortman, I absolutely agree with you. I think that really gets back to the heart of why Truth and Taxation was started, and it did, as I mentioned earlier, it did bring out at the beginning a lot of people, but then as people, I think, got used to getting the notices and understanding what they were, then they didn't feel that compelled to go to the meetings, but they still valued the information. So I think you are absolutely accurate on what, at least how I understand it, and
Madam Chair.
The opportunity is there, but it's not necessarily that's not necessarily the mission of the Truth in Taxation. Senator Skoy.
And the only thing I would add to your conversation is, as long as the people didn't just give up and not attend.
Exactly. Right.
And Madam Chair, if I could just correct the record here.
Mr. Carlson.
I said if the objective of the Truth in Taxation notice is to get people to turn out of the hearing, it's failing in that effort.
Rather than saying
that
that's
provides information,
yes,
that's useful regardless of whether or not the individuals show up.
And could I
appreciate correction. Senator Skoy, then Senator Nelson.
And could I get some clarification from Mr. Carlson? The $3 million was just the county costs?
No.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, as some of the older members of the committee know, the Department of Revenue was required to do a study on Truth and Taxation back in 2008, I believe. And they identified total costs of approximately $3.5 million. And under current law, the county is allowed to charge the cities and towns and school districts each one-third of that respective amount.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two comments. The timing's rather interesting on this. I got a call in my office yesterday from a gentleman who got his truth in tax, his estimated property tax statement. And on there was a change in the homestead. Inadvertently, it had something to do with papers that were misfiled with the new loan or something. And the call was, you should have noticed it before when he called in. And so I guess my point is that there's a lot of information that comes when we send those to our taxpayers beyond the rate. Also, they're able to make sure that they're still homesteaded and that type of thing. So I think we have to be careful to make sure that taxpayers are still getting that information. And then my other comment is we have a lot of new tools today. We have a lot of digital tools. And perhaps there's a way to look at digitally reducing the cost instead of mailing the truth in taxation statements. I know a lot of municipalities do communicate with their citizens through electronic media now, through email, and that might be a way to look at reducing the cost but making sure that the taxpayers still get the information.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
I did look at whether it would be something to consider as trying to move the notice up a little bit somehow. There was pushback on that also. We did talk about, Senator Nelson, just about electronic notification. Not all property owners have that access to that, so that becomes an issue. But, I think it's things that can certainly help get the word out, but I don't think they can be the only thing.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Carlson Nelson.
So, and my question would be, does current law prohibit counties or municipalities from using digital communication as opposed to mailed communication? In other words, shouldn't be one or the other. Certainly we need to use all the tools in our toolbox. What's the current status of that?
Madam Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, current statute allows an individual to request notice by electronic means. The problem is we have to have absolute certainty that we get the tax statement to individuals. So basically, I think almost all counties where that option is exercised, they do both. They accommodate the electronic delivery, but to have certainty that the tax statement or the truth in taxation or valuation notices are delivered, they still use the mail because there's never any certainty that the email address that they have is the current occupant's, or the current occupant has perhaps changed his or her email address because they've changed ISPs.
And the mail that is put in the post office, that if it doesn't reach the right address or whatever, it's returned to the county, so they would know that it was not received for one reason or another, whatever it would be. Senator Nelson.
But not to belabor this, but I think moving into the new technologies is really important for government. And I will say that that takes several days for the returned mail and the cost there as well. But I will say there is certainly digital tools available today to confirm the accuracy of an email address before a notice would be sent out. And there are also tools to be notified when something is sent to an inaccurate email address. So I guess my comment would be just for us to encourage us to look at how we can embrace and use new technologies to better streamline. And this would be one example. Not that it's the only, but it's just another tool.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Gary Carlson from the League. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Cities. And let me just say at the outset, we don't have a position in support or in opposition to the specifics of this bill, but I do have some information that I've received from our cities that I think will be helpful as you consider this piece of legislation. Let me also say that we always appreciate the legislature reviewing mandates and seeing if they're really accomplishing the various goals that we intend for those mandates. This truth in taxation law was enacted in 1988. I think, Senator Rest, you were in the House at the time. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, I think this was Representative DeLong's initiative. And so we've had 25 years of experience with the truth in taxation law, and it's gone through many, many iterations. I think it started out as just a notice that provided gross levy information for the taxing jurisdictions. It evolved into a specific parcel notice for individuals, and then now it has been streamlined a little bit and the process has been modified. But our cities have grown used to the process. So let me just share with you some of the observations. First of all, on website availability, the bill does require that we post information on the hearing and on our budgets in subdivision, I think it's in that second paragraph, on our website. And this only applies to cities over 2,500 population. To the best of my ability, I looked at how many of those cities right now have a website, and I think of the 226, I count 225 that actually have a website, so I just want to leave that out there. That's much better participation in the web than we've had in the past, but only one city that I could count does not have a website. Mr. Carlson indicated some of the concerns over the tax rate calculations, and we agree with the difficulty of having accurate tax rate information, especially with respect to the fiscal disparities program in the metro area and on the Iron Range. And that is challenged. It's made better by your amendment to move to September 30th, but it is still challenged as a part of this process. The bill does require countywide notification, I'm sorry, it requires that we post in a newspaper with countywide circulation information about the hearing. That is a change from current law where cities would have to use their official newspaper to notify citizens of the meeting, and we'd have to look at the application of that to cities in specific. It may be more costly under that notification requirement. And then finally, let me leave you with a couple of other general observations that I received, and again, I'm not trying to support or oppose the bill specifically, but many cities talked about the transparency of the process and how they've grown used to using this tool as a way to educate the public. One thing that Mr. Keith Carlson and I heard from the NIOP folks at a hearing or meeting we had on truth and taxation last year was that many of the business owners actually appreciate receiving that notice November timeframe, because they use that to allocate the property taxes for the upcoming year's leases for commercial property. And that was something we were totally unaware of. But it was a benefit that some of the business owners found to that early notice. Although it's not exact, it does give them a rough idea of at least the property tax portion of the upcoming year's taxes. And then finally, several of our cities have said to me, if our citizens don't get this information on the notice, are we going to get phone call after phone call telling us or asking us, can you calculate my taxes and tell me what they would be? And some concern over additional burden on cities and perhaps counties of trying to help their citizens more fully understand the exact impacts on their property tax statements. With that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions.
Any questions or comments directed to Mr. Carlson? Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. The next person I have is Mr. Ralph Erickson. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm Ralph Erickson. I'm chairman of RPT Minnesota Reform Property Taxes, very small nonprofit, trying to work for the citizens. I'm also a city assessor of six cities in western Hennepin County. I'm not a government employee, but I have a small company. We contract with the cities to do their tax assessing. We are in favor, in general, of this bill. I'll say in general, we just have a couple of suggestions. Most everything's been covered on this. So we understand the timing and everything, but I suggest that we're really dealing with two issues. When we're talking about truth and budgeting, we're talking about each entity and what they're spending. And if this would be for the people who are really concerned with their city and what their city is spending, if they're spending more or less, or how they're spending the money. And I think this is why moving the date back to the 30th, even though you don't have a complete tax rate set, would be very helpful, because this is a time when the people in each jurisdiction can actually have an input in it. We would suggest that as far as the notice goes, I think it is beneficial to have a notice, but I think that the county, if the county can do it, they've got all they should be able to do it electronically and not necessarily be required to mail it out. Because, first of all, if somebody, so many people go online now and look up their neighbor's values, and I know in Hennepin we've got a pretty good system, and I don't know how some of the other more rural counties are, but I think that if a county can do it, they should be allowed just to do electronically and not necessarily have to mail them out. And I don't know if you realize or not, but when these notices are sent out in regard with email and not having correct emails on people, the same thing goes for paper notices too. We get stacks of things back that aren't corrected, and they don't have a forwarding address, and there's limited time to deal with to trying to find the people. So there's probably, I don't know if it's 1 or 2%, but never make it to the people anyway. So the other thing that we would like to suggest, too, is that there'd be an electronic component to the taxation hearing, or not hearings, but the meetings that the cities would hold, or the county would hold, or the Met Council. And what we'd like to suggest is that something maybe even as simple as just having a conference call line where people could call in and ask questions of the meeting. I know that some of the cities now, when they're on cable TV and everything else, it would be simple to have a call-in just like a talk show. And, you know, on the cities that aren't as sophisticated, or the counties, even just having a conference call line, because even in Hennepin County, you might have to drive 45 miles to go to the Met Council if you live out in Rockford, say, or something. So we are in favor of this bill, but we would like to see again, just to reiterate, we would like to see the notices sent electronically. I won't say sent, but just be available electronically so that landlord can know, I can go on that site, I can look it up, I can see what my taxes are proposed to be. And this would be a savings then if the counties didn't have to actually mail that. And then the other thing, again, we'd like to see is the electronic component to the actual budget meetings, where people wouldn't necessarily have to drive 40 or 50 miles to come to a meeting and take all that extra time. So, thank you, and that's thank you again for the opportunity to testify. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions or comments for Mr. Erickson? Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, just not necessarily Mr. Erickson, but just a general comment. I like the idea overall, you know, trying to get the public engaged more, but I'd share some of the other concerns that have been expressed. That notice, I think, is extremely important for citizens. We just have these discussions all the time, as Senator Scoy knows and others, that in other committees, that, you know, sending things out electronically or not sending things out at all is problematic, and our desire is to engage. And I appreciate the conversation, but I think certainly we had to keep mailing those things out. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Erickson. Is there anyone else who would like to testify regarding Senate File 1563?
Oh, my goodness. Hi.
We're going to hear from the schools.
Schools.
This bill has a lot of attention.
Yeah.
Senator Scoy, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I want to thank Senator Scoy for bringing this forward and the committee for giving us the opportunity to share our story. School districts are very different from counties and cities, and our budget year does not conform to the same budget time schedule cities and counties do. We are on the state fiscal year, right, and we are making our budget final process and deciding on our budget in March. And by the time if the September 30th date came around, that budget cycle would be three-fourths completed and not yet addressed on that. That's due to a time that we are supposed to notify our tenured staff if they are not going to have a continuing contract. Those notices are due out by April 1st, so it's really part of the law going forward. Our other concern is many of schools have a levy component in their funding. Last night I was trying to do some quick tabulation, and I came up with 21 different aid levy mixes that fund schools, the majority of which we have no say in, but that's what you folks do here. The biggies I tried to identify, the referendum levy is $763 million for FY13. That's done by voter approval. The debt service levy is also part of that funding, and that's $810 million. Our equity levy is up to $74 million. That's done by state law. Health and safety levies, about $53 million there. Our operating capital levies, $113 million. But all those levies are based on the number of children we serve and the numbers which you, in fact, enact in your K-12 budget bills. So with that, the budget portion of this bill, the levy system works, and I'll let Ms. Dozlin talk to how that system works for K-12 because it comes through the Department of Education. But the budget information are asking for our public to share and be part of our budget cycle, these dates are very problematic. So we have tried for years to share that with the tax committee and have not been successful in sharing that. We are really need some differing dates if you want us to do it to meet the goals in this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
So, Madam Chair, can I just follow up?
Sure. Senator Senjum.
And thank you, and thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Why do I seem to recall that at least where I live, city, county, and school district, within the framework of, I don't know, a month or so, all have now their truth and taxation hearing. Isn't that the correct?
Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chairman, Senator St. John, you are correct, but at that hearing, school districts will give you sort of their dated budget information. So it's 3/4 completed. It's not really being put together. And our levy certification. School boards have the local authority to set something like the Safe Schools levy, which is capped at $30 per child. We can decide we want to bring that levy down. Normally, we certify the max and then be in that truth and taxation hearing, take information from the public, and the board can adjust that. Other pieces of that school boards have the authority to adjust locally would be your community education levies, your ECFE, yeah. Adult basic education, all relatively minor pieces in a total school district budget.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozeland, and I represent the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. They're the school finance directors, the school accounting staff. They are the ones who are behind the truth and taxation hearings, and they would be the ones who would be responsible for the work of this bill. We do not have a position either way on Senator Skoy's bill. I think if you talk to your business managers, they do a lot of this already. We do have logistical questions. The timing just is not workable for the way school districts operate. While September 30th is a better date, it's still problematic. The Department of Education has to notify the school districts of their preliminary levy calculations by September 8th, and that is, I think if you talk to the department, they will say that that's a struggle for them to get them that to the school districts by September 8th. School districts must certify their levies by September 30th. So the September 30th date is just problematic. And just one other technical feature. Clause C of the bill says that the notice of the budget meeting and the budget and levy information must be published on the website 5 days prior to the hearing and also in a newspaper within 10 days prior to the hearing. If they don't get the levy information from the department until September 8th, that's right around when they would have to be getting the notice information ready for the newspaper publication. One other a challenge that we have with newspaper publications, this is a lot of information to have to submit for in a newspaper publication. Right now, school districts publish their budget information in newspapers, but it's a summary. This is a lot of detailed information that would have to be provided and at likely a significant cost to school districts. So, we do have concerns about
and there's often a week lag. I mean, some local newspapers are only weeklies, and you have to get it in. If you want it in on the 15th, you have to get the information on the 7th or something like that. So
exactly, Madam Chair.
Not a daily daily publication. Any questions or comments from Ms. Dozeland? Seeing none, Senator Skoy, any final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members and testifiers for the discussion. There were a couple recommendations of the working group that I've worked on this year. I'm having better luck with the other one. So,
there being no further discussion, the chair lays over Senate File 1530. 1563 as amended. Senator Skoy, we did get the updated revenue estimate for 1536 that reflects the A2 amendment, which was the adjustment for inflation and indexing on the PILT payments having been removed. So if Ms. McQuaid has that revenue estimate for you for your information. Tomorrow we will meet Senator Skoy to consider two omnibus bills. Would you like to talk about that for a minute?
Madam Chair and members and to the public, we will have the Health and Human Services bill. I think the K-12 bill might be in the afternoon. There is a potential that we will see the economic development, environment, and ag bill. but that is unknown at this point if we'll actually see that or not. But there is the potential for that. As soon as we know, we'll get notice out so everybody can be informed. But I think we're scheduled to meet at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Senator Scoy, is it your intent that we would meet at 8:30 and then we will be recessed for the floor session and then
yes.
return? Is the committee going to meet Saturday morning, or we'll just be on floor session on Saturday?
Madam Chair, my intention is not to meet Saturday morning unless we would have to meet to
And I think Senator Bach had indicated that the session would begin somewhere around 9 o'clock anyway, so
yeah.
so that we perhaps could be done by early afternoon. Any questions or comments from any other member about the schedule?
Okay.
Seeing none, then the committee stands adjourned until tomorrow.